Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service. Catch all the hard-hitting news and current affairs that focuses on all relevant First Nations issues from a First Nations standpoint. This is Bo Spearham with Let's Talk.
Good morning and welcome to Let's Talk. Before I go on any further, I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners on the land that we are broadcasting from, and also to as well. Also, I'd like to pay my respects to our elders, and also our elders of more recent arrival. And a big shout out to everybody from around the continent that is taking our program via the National Indigenous Radio Service, NIRS. Also, if you're tuning in via our app, 98.9FM for the best country, which you can download for free from your app store, so please do so. And don't forget, you can stream us via our website, 98.9fm.com.au, and via our website, this program is podcasted. You can also check out previous Let's Talk programs. You can also listen to us and stream us via Spotify and Apple Podcast. Those platforms beaming us into your communities, and as always, it is great to have your company. On the show, I'm going to be chatting with NITV journalist who's been doing some amazing stories as of recently. But before we get to that, and what I'm going to talk about next will be what I'll be yarning with my guest about. Well, but I would like to sort of talk a bit about what happened in Moree. Yesterday, there was a march through the town centre, and it was a march for a 22-year-old Gumroi man by the name of Gordon Copeland, who has been missing, I believe, since the 10th of this month. He was last seen heading into a river in the Gwydir River just outside of Moree in the northern parts of New South Wales. The family, you know, have been searching. I believe it was like 5 days in, the police stopped an SES call of their official searches. But the community of Moree, the family, our friends and broader community of Moree have been continuing to search for this young man as well. And yesterday was to raise a bit of more awareness about what happened to him and his whereabouts as well. And hopefully pushing the police to get up and continue their searches as every moment counts. More people do as well. Sad times in Moree, but it was great to see so many different and familiar faces out there marching in solidarity with the family and community in Moree yesterday as well. My guest is a Barkindji woman and also a journalist from NITV. Good morning, sis. How are you going?
I'm good, thank you, Bo. How are you this morning?
Good, good, good. And for our listeners, my guest, Jeanette, sis, could you tell us your name, your mob, and where you're from?
Yeah, no worries. Thanks so much for having me on this morning. Let's talk. I'm so excited to be here. My name is Jeanette Quinn Bates. I am a proud Barkindji woman. I grew up in Musselbrook in New South Wales, currently living in Sydney. So I am
in lockdown.
I am locked down, but I'm, you know, very blessed. I've still got a job and I'm still able to go to the office a few days a week. So, I'm sending my love and, you know, prayers to everyone that aren't as fortunate as myself in these times. They're very, very hard times. So, grew up in Musselbrook. I've moved around the country quite a bit. I've lived in Brizzy for a little, Gold Coast. I miss the sunshine up there so much. Soak it up for me, guys. I've did a bit of study in the Northern Territory. I did a stint with ABC Alice Springs. That was incredible experience. Highly recommend going and seeing the territory if you haven't seen that part of the country yet. So back in Sydney now with NITV and absolutely loving it, telling the mob stories. You know, this is me. I'm where I'm supposed to be. So, yeah, happy to be here yarning with you this morning about some of my latest yarns that I've done and helped some of the important voices that I've helped elevate.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to talk a bit about some of those voices that you have been elevating throughout your journalism career as well. But first, how did you get involved in journalism?
So I've actually only been involved in the media industry for a couple of years, probably just over 2 years. I actually wanted to be an actor. That was kind of what I thought my dreams were, where my passion lied in performing arts, I guess. So I did look into working on screen and did a bit of media study, and it kind of just took off from there. I still do consider it, I guess, to be a form of acting. The voice I use for my reporting is definitely not the voice I use at home with my cousins and my mob, and you know, so there is a certain level of acting in there, but it's just so much more important and powerful for me to be able to tell our stories. And you know, the media have power. They have the power to basically tell the story, to tell the narrative, to include who they want to include and to leave out who they want to leave out. And for too long, I think every black fella can relate to seeing some type of content in the media that they either can't relate to or that, you know, even offends them because of, you know, some of the stereotypes that are afforded to our mob. So I just really, I guess I wanted to play a part in helping to empower our people and helping to change that narrative and some of those stereotypes that are placed upon mob. And yeah, I think, you know, we are deadly. We are beautiful culture, and we definitely don't get the credit that we deserve a lot of the time. And so, yeah, that's probably the thing I've enjoyed most about telling our yarns, is just showcasing to the world, really, the beauty of First Nations culture in this country.
No, definitely, sis. So at the moment you're involved in a bit of, I guess, TV and also online journalism. Is that where you started, or was it radio? Or what were you doing in Alice Springs? Sorry, what form of media were you doing? Yeah.
I've done a kind of a bit of everything, I guess. In Alice, I actually did start out as a trainee. So, you know, there's always ways for people to get their foot in the door. If they don't have experience, that was my way. So, and I guess I just picked up my skills along the way. As a journo, you do keep your eye out for those stories, those strong yarns, those ones that people are going to want to read, or that, you know, the ones that people need to read. And I was, you know, the community out there, I love Central Australia. It's just a part of the country that has the culture still so strong. It's so beautiful. You know, there's different languages out there. There's a few different language groups out there. And yeah, like I just said, the culture that's out there, the stories that I could tell out there are like unlike anywhere else in the country that I would be able to tell stories like that. So
And just on that, since was it a big thing for you to sort of move from Muswellbrook, from the East Coast, to Central Australia and experience essentially like a whole new world in terms of, you know, getting more immersed in journalism and also, you know, just seeing sort of how rich and how strong sort of, you know, cultural language and things like that are for mob out that way?
Oh, definitely. I like to go walk about. You know, I've moved around a fair bit. I was in Queensland, actually, and I started studying. I found media courses in the Territory, started studying up there, and believe it or not, it was the first time I'd actually ever heard mob talk in lingo, like fluently, like it was their first language, and it was the most beautiful thing I'd ever heard. And I just loved it. I fell in love with the culture. I fell in love with every aspect of it, and it was so strong up there that I just wanted, you know, I wanted to learn. I wanted to see more, learn more. I loved it. So I actually looked for jobs in the Territory because I knew that there was so much for me to learn up there, and there's still so much. So I was really, really lucky enough to find the job that I found. I manifested that. I wanted it so badly, and it's paved the way for where I am now. And it definitely was a massive culture shock, you know, moving from the East Coast way over there. They definitely have a different life to us here in the city, out there in the desert, and they definitely have different issues that they deal with. So I can completely understand why you know, some of the mob out there kind of look at some of us city mobs and some of the things we advocate for sometimes and just go, what? Because it just is 10 worlds away from them. So I just, I'm blessed for that opportunity to be able to see a bit better what some of the mob out there deal with. So, you know, I think, so us mob over here that do have access to resources where we can elevate voices, we got to remember our mob out there in the bush and, you know, in the communities that are still living with so much beautiful culture. And yeah, they've got important voices out there too that need elevating. So we, you know, we can't forget about mob out there. But nah, it was the best experience of my life. I can't wait to go back. If it wasn't for these borders being closed, I would have gone back for a visit already for sure.
Well, let's sort of talk about, you know, doing journalism now sort of under COVID, you know, sort of, you know, how difficult has it been to sort of try and report under sort of these COVID times?
It's more been, I guess, it's doable. We've discovered that. It's definitely doable. But I definitely much more enjoy that face-to-face interaction, especially with the mob. You know, I pride myself in the work I do as a First Nations journalist to be able to pull some of the yarns out of some of our mob is because I can, you know, make them comfortable enough to talk to me. And I can relate to, you know, a lot of the stories and a lot of the things that they talk about. So it's just been more so, I definitely enjoy that in-person interaction. Like I said, we've discovered it's doable, but I, you know, trying to cover that rally yesterday in Moree, that family, they were great. But it is definitely really hard when I'm sitting here in Sydney. I've got a camera person out there who's doing shooting, and the young lady who did out the shooting for that yesterday was brilliant. She got some great footage. But it's definitely a lot harder to do it remotely. And, you know, I've done interviews where there was three young artists in Alice Springs that did Bantua, that did these graphic novels, and they were beautiful books, and, you know, I'm basically having to say to them, describe to me, you know, paint the picture, because I'm, you know, I'm not there. I couldn't see. So I guess it does bring a little extra conversation in that sense, but yeah, so it's doable. It's just not as enjoyable.
Yeah, definitely, sis. Also, let's sort of yarn about some of the stories that you have been doing as of recently. A few weeks ago, here in Brisbane, where is it now? Here, it's lost track of my notes. We'll just talk of yesterday's rally. You did, as you mentioned, you know, you had a video journalist there shooting some of the protest yesterday. Could you tell us a bit about the protest?
Yeah, so there was crowds that marched yesterday in Moree, basically in the hopes that they could put enough pressure on the police to open the search back up. They stopped searching, concluded the search on the 15th of July, on the Thursday. I think that was 5 days after young Gordon Copeland went missing. The family are very grateful for community members who have lent, you know, kayaks and have helped with resources and have helped with the search. But as family members say, it's near impossible with the resources that they've got. And when I approached the police for a response to the search and what's happening, obviously they won't provide too much comment when there is investigations underway, I guess. But, you know, they did say that in the email that they sent back to me that they had engaged the New South Wales Rural Fire Service, the Fire and Rescue, SES, Police Rescue, Marine Area Command. These were all services that they listed as had helped with the search for 22-year-old Gordon Copeland, who has a 3-year-old and another child on the way. So you can imagine his family are distraught. So I being the little Doris of a journo that I am, sent emails to these services and just asked about, you know, their involvement with the search, any comments that they could give, kind of knowing that they wouldn't give much being under police investigation, which is pretty much the comment that I got. But the fire and rescue got back to me and said, I believe you're meaning to contact the SES. You know, they basically said they, you know, you've contacted the wrong person. And I just said, just letting you know, the police have listed you as services in their response. Is it, you know, were you not involved? And then they kind of basically said we were involved upon police asking. But family members have said that they have approached the SES, and the SES said that they're unable to assist unless instructed to by the police. So it looks as if, you know, police have the ability to make these calls. They're just choosing not to. And, you know, today's 19, it's been 19 days. It was 18 yesterday when my story ran, so 19, and I'm counting. So I can imagine, you know, that poor family. And, you know, when they were talking about the search, they said, you know, we wanted the police to go upstream, you know, as blackfellas, they know how the water runs in this, I guess. And the police said, oh, it doesn't constitute with their reporting or their assessments or whatever. So they wouldn't search the areas that the family wanted them to. It was the police have denied to the family that they were in pursuit of the car that Gordon was a passenger in. But last Thursday, the family, through a meeting with the ALS, the Aboriginal Legal Service, they were permitted to watch the footage, and they say it was very clearly a police pursuit. So I guess we are just trying to keep this pressure on the police, because I believe the family want it classed as a pursuit.
For sure, definitely.
And a death in custody if his body's found. So, sending love to all the mob in Moree and everyone around the country that, you know, has mob in Moree, because I've been heartbroken since I first read up this story. And then, it's very heavy.
Definitely, sis, definitely. Also, you know, just recently done a story on Mungo Man and Mungo Lady as well. Some of the oldest remains found outside of Africa. Could you tell us a bit about that story, sister? That must have been very interesting as well.
Oh, I did, and it was the most historically significant story I've ever done, I guess. And for those of you that are familiar with Mungo Man and Mungo Lady, they are part of the story. For those who aren't, Mungo Man and Mungo Lady are remains that were found in the Willandra Lakes area, which is in southwestern New South Wales, home to Lake Mungo, hence the name. Along with Mungo Man and Mungo Lady, there is 106 other remains. So there are of 108 ancestral remains found down there. So scientists first discovered Mungo Lady in 1968. So thinking it was just bones, they then clearly discovered a year later it was a human. 5 years later, in 1974, Mungo Man was found. These two people are so significant. After testing, they discovered that they were at least 42,000 years old. So it actually rewrote history as people knew it, because that was a lot older than, you know, any evidence of human movement, I guess, on this continent. So pretty significant. And amongst artifacts and many other things down there in the Willandra Lakes region, they've been dated to about 45,000 years old. But so this site is so significant. It was one of the first sites in the country to actually be listed as a UNESCO World Heritage Site. So it was in 1981. It was the same year that the Great Barrier Reef and Kakadu National Park were listed. So they were the first three sites in the whole country, just to give you an idea of the significance of this place. And so it has always been known how great these finds are. Anyways, there has been discussions for, you know, we're half a century now, been 50 years since they were found, about what should be done with them. And elders involved have always wanted a keeping place that they can be stored in out there on country. There is talk of further research being able to be done, facilitated by, you know, traditional custodians and in a respectful, cultural, appropriate way, and then for the bones and remains to be able to go back into this keeping place. But so this has been talked about for, you know, some decades. It's been talked about for decades, and the resolution obviously has just, there hasn't, it seems the consultation process hasn't happened or hasn't happened to the extent that it definitely should have. There's three traditional owner groups involved in these discussions, and that's the Mati Mati, the Barkindji, and the Miampa. So it's a bit complicated, but for the most part, pretty much everybody wants some type of keeping place. There is one or two who are for this secret reburial who I can't get a hold of. They won't talk to me. So as it is at the moment, there is a New South Wales government proposal that was done through Parks and Wildlife to rebury all of these remains in unmarked graves in a private ceremony. So essentially they will be lost because obviously, only the people that are involved in this these private ceremonies will know where they are. They're not going to be marked or any type of memorial put there. So, obviously, the communities are up in arms because it's such a great loss. But it's not just the Aboriginal community that's, you know, devastated over this. The national scientific world, international scientific world is just, you know, does not want this to go ahead because most of these remains have never been tested. So we have Mungo Man and Mungo Lady there. There's 106 others. And like some of the anthropologists and bioarchaeologists and the people with the big titles that I've spoken to just say, you know, there's the potential that some of these remains could be even older. The stories that are there, the fact that there is basically a community of people that can tell this story, not just, you know, a couple of individuals, which you can, you know, a lot of assumptions can be made. But, you know, these remains are just so significant. Mungo Lady is the oldest evidence on earth of ceremonial burial. She was cremated. Showing, you know, she was mourned by a family. Mungo Man, he had his hands crossed in his lap and he was sprinkled with red ochre. So these two humans actually provide the oldest evidence of ceremonial burial. It's quite, like I said, it's huge. It's such a big loss if we do lose them, because there's so much, I think, anyway. So many stories to be told here. And like I said, it's not just First Nations people that are wanting this stopped. It's, you know, experts who are aware of the value of these remains, not just to our people, but to the world.
Definitely.
So, yeah.
Oh, for sure. It's just, you know, some of the oldest remains in the world, as you just mentioned, you know, needs to be preserved, respected, honoured as well. We are sort of getting to the end of the program, Sis. And I just wanted to quickly ask you in regards to another story that you've written as well. It was about the uprising in Parklea Correctional Centre in New South Wales a couple of weeks ago, where what we saw was some Aboriginal inmates climb on the roofs and sort of, you know, in protest.
Yeah, so 14 inmates took to the roof of Parklea Prison. Obviously, the media, other mainstream media organisations did report it as a riot after speaking with families. And obviously, after seeing vision, these boys, you know, they were up there holding their fists in the air, they spelled out BLM on the roof in with items of their clothing to get the attentions of the helicopters that were filming. So it was quite clear to be a protest over race, which after talking with partners of fellas in there and loved ones, family members, they confirmed that that's exactly what it was. It was a protest against the poor treatment of prisoners in Parklea, but in particular the First Nations prisoners. Some of the accounts that I have been relayed by loved ones is absolutely appalling. I definitely, it hit me, so I can imagine how they're feeling, and just some of the reports of, you know, absolute neglect, of mental health needs not being met, of medication being withheld. Some of these fellas have...
Not even, you know, having visits as well from families due to COVID as well.
Oh, some of, you know, there's people that haven't had visits for, you know, we'd be going on 2 years, you know. I know that there has been periods where visitors have been back, you know, they're doing video links and stuff like that. But, you know, I know in myself, just being locked down here in a unit by myself, you know, to not get out or to not have that human interaction. But so, and I've heard of, you know, the bullying, in particular by the guards. You know, Parklea Prison is a privately owned prison, which I have heard from legal experts and loved ones of people in these facilities that makes it a lot harder to try and, you know, find out exactly what's going on or things like that. And all of those loved ones after that protest, those boys, they could not get a hold of them. They didn't hear from them for at least, I think it was 3 days before the first partner had heard, and that was like a 2-minute phone call max. And it was because it was her son's birthday. So some of them waited days. There was one young fellow who, when he did speak to his mum or his loved one, that it had been 5 days. He hadn't had a shower. But, like I said, the conditions that these fellows are getting kept in is just inhumane. I've heard reports of them being stripped bare, no clothes, and that's how they're left and expected to be able to sleep, you know, no blanket, nothing, absolutely nothing. Being starved, not getting, you know, food, not getting water, just really, really poor treatment. So Parklea is run by a private international company, actually, called MTC Broad Spectrum, and they have quite a poor record internationally of their treatment of inmates. So those 14 that were on the roof were taken down by tactical guards using tear gas and pepper spray. And I'm sure anyone who saw that footage saw how it was hostile. So let's not forget that, you know, our brothers inside need our voices as well. And they definitely need that communication and they need those supports. They're just not getting. I would just wish there was more I could do.
Thanks for coming on this morning, sis, as well. And if you are just tuning in to Let's Talk as well, my guest this morning, Sister Jeanette Quinn Bates from NITV, Barkindji woman. Sis, all the stories that we spoke about, where can our listeners go and have a read or watch some of your stories?
So I am an NITV journalist, so any of the TV stories you can watch on the NITV News or Noola, which is our Friday weekly news program. They're all available to watch on SBS On Demand. All of my articles are also on the NITV site. I do have a link tree, which is on my Twitter and on my Instagram. So thank you so much for having me on, my brother.
That's all, you know, good, sis. Yeah. Also, you started that page yesterday as well?
Sorry?
Yeah, you started a page where people can like and follow your stories as well on Facebook.
Oh, I did. Thanks for reminding me. Yeah, we'll see how that goes, eh?
And then just for our listeners, like, do you want to plug that page, sis?
Yeah, so Jeanette Quinn Bates, it's just a new like page that I created yesterday. So we'll see how I go. I am going to try and start putting my work on there to separate personal life and work. But no, thanks again for having me on, my brother. It's been deadly. I wish I could start every work morning this way.
Yes, no, for sure, sis. No, it was good to have you on. Very good work that you are doing down there as well, sis.
Thank you very much, my brother. And just a quick shout out to the mob, to everyone, you know, any black news, please feel free to contact me anytime. That's what I'm here for, is to tell the stories of First Nations people in this country. So, you know, get at me anytime. But thanks. It's been a pleasure.
And thank you, Sister Jeanette from NITV, for joining us on the program this morning. If you've enjoyed the program, you can catch the podcast. It'll be up 98.9fm.com.au.